Welcome to Playmakers Talk Show, where business owners, professionals, and entrepreneurs gather to discover playmaking ideas for success. Your host is internationally recognized speaker, facilitator, and author, Steve Klein, who sits down with fascinating playmakers who have made themselves and their company successful. Steve will introduce you to CEOs and executives who discuss their playmaking path toward success. And now, it's time to meet this show's playmaker. Here's your host, Steve Klein.
Margaret Thatcher said, "Disciplining yourself to do what you know is right and important, although difficult, is the high road to pride, self-esteem, and personal satisfaction." Welcome to Playmakers Talk Show. I'm Steve Klein. In the studio today is a guest who is disciplined to do what is right for her clients. Today's Playmakers role model is also Margaret Thatcher. With us today is a company president who is a director of media relations for the White House and special assistant to President Ronald Reagan. This great playmaker is Mary Spaeth. Mary is founder and president of Spaeth Communications, which is a Dallas-based firm that provides communication training and consulting. Recognized internationally for its unique methodology, Spaeth defines communication as influence. Effective communication goes beyond what you want to say or what you think your audience needs to know. It's about influencing what people hear, believe, remember, and pass on. Before founding Spaeth in 1987, Mary was a producer for ABC's 2020, a speechwriter for the legendary founder and chairman of CBS, William S. Paley, and was assigned to FBI Director Judge William Webster while serving as a White House Fellow. All this culminated into her roles as Director of Public Affairs for the Federal Trade Commission, and ultimately her appointment as Director of Media Relations at the White House and Special Assistant to President Ronald Reagan. Well, Mary, welcome to Playmakers Talk Show.
Pleasure.
Well, this will be interesting. Thank you. First question I want to ask you about going way back to when you were a child. Did your first job at the age of 12 define your attitude and approach to business?
Well, you're talking about my car washing business. My dad gave me a gadget that you hooked up to a hose, and I got $2, and he matched it, so I got $4, and I went around our area of Philadelphia washing people's cars. And it certainly did influence me because it made me think that work is what you hustle for. You got to go ask for it. And second of all, if you ask for help, you have anybody else who needs a car that's going to be washed? People will be very generous and kind to you. That's really the story of our life in business. People have been very kind to us.
Well, you had another job a couple of years later at the age of 14. There was a movie being produced.
Yes.
Tell us what that was and how you got picked to do that.
The movie was The World of Henry Orient, starring Peter Sellers and Angela Lansbury, directed by George Roy Hill. It's about two little girls growing up in New York, and George wanted two non-professional little girls, and so they looked all across the United States. And I really simply stumbled into the part because I was fairly tall but very clumsy, and George thought that I looked like the part. It was a great experience. It was the U.S.'s nominee for the Cannes Film Festival the next year, so I got to go and represent the United States abroad as well. Another fabulous and unusual experience.
You've had a number of unusual experiences that we're going to talk about in a moment, but let's back up a little bit and talk about communications. Why are you in the communications business?
Well, I guess I shouldn't say just lucky. I started thinking about communication in my brief journalism career, but when I got to the Federal Trade Commission as the Director of Public Affairs, we were taking over from the Carter administration, and my boss was the co-chairman of President Reagan's deregulatory effort, and we needed to get out of Washington and explain to the American public why deregulation was good for them. And so I started working with the lawyers who were all career staff at the FTC. And then it became, of course, immediately clear that they needed some training because they may have been fantastic antitrust or consumer protection lawyers, but that wasn't the same as going out to the Omaha Chamber of Commerce and building public confidence and trust. And so that's when I started thinking about this as an organized program, and that culminated once we got here to Dallas in my company.
Let's go back even farther. How did you get into the government out of school?
Well, the White House Fellows Program was started by John Gardner, who was Secretary of HHS at that point under President Johnson, and it was modeled on the Rhodes Scholarship. designed to bring highly talented people to Washington. Of course, in my case, obviously, there's always a ringer or an exception. But I got through the process, and as you mentioned, got assigned to Bill Webster at the FBI, the first fellow to be assigned there. And I think anybody would tell you I had one of the most extraordinary years that any fellow has ever had. If you're at a bigger cabinet agency, you may see the secretary once a month. I saw Director Webster four times a morning. Now, I was the lowest of the special assistants. They all had very specific assignments in the Bureau, and I got mop-up or clean-up, which I actually thought was the most interesting staff position because you never knew what you were going to get assigned.
Well, you were younger at that time, and you were just building up all this experience by getting all that exposure. As a business, where you work with companies, help them understand how to communicate, what's the biggest challenge that these businesses face regarding communications, and how do they overcome those challenges?
Well, the biggest challenge, I think, Stephen, my first goal is to change how they think about communication. It's not your hand gestures. It's not your eye contact. It's really how you think about communication as what we call a strategic business skill. And once people start thinking about this just the way they think of any other financial discipline, then you build it across your enterprise and everybody gets involved in it. And it's very helpful to have a consistent philosophy of communication, which you alluded to earlier. We say it's not what you want to say or what people you think people need to know. It's influencing what they hear, what they believe, and what they remember. And then understanding that everybody that you deal with goes and talks or communicates with somebody else, so they become potentially your ambassador. So building in that kind of approach is really what we hope to do with companies. It gives you a competitive edge you can't erode. It recognizes that your own employees are your best recruiting tool, and that they are, particularly in today's age of social media, they are the people who are liable to be communicating about you with, hey, I hear you work for Amalgamated, you know. Weren't they the people who just, you know, so understanding and involving everybody who's part of the organization is a strategic choice. Then we work with them on understanding the model that we've designed, which looks at the various routes of communication and say, are we using all of them, and is our message aligned? And it's over, gosh, now 30 years, we've carved out a niche for ourselves with some very large clients, but also a lot of really wonderful up-and-coming clients like Topgolf and Bain Clinic. And these are the stars. I guess they're the stars of today, but they're certainly the stars of tomorrow as well.
As I mentioned at the opening, that you define communication as influence, which you had mentioned before. When I think of influence, I think of selling. If you are attempting to influence somebody, you want them to buy into your ideas. How did you develop that? How did you realize that that's really what communication is all about?
Well, I guess I go back to the Federal Trade Commission again. We were out selling the idea that deregulation, sensible regulation, is good for consumers. Remember, this is the Federal Trade Commission under Carter, which told the Clairol company, the hair color company, that they couldn't advertise that hair color that they sold was permanent because it didn't change the color of hair that had yet to come in. So understanding one is selling an idea as much as selling a product. And today, selling is a multifaceted concept. Most of the clients that we're dealing with, even ones who are like FedEx offering a product, are really building a relationship. No good company today really is looking for a one-off. What they want is to develop a relationship with the people that they serve. And that attitude is a big change than I'm here to sell you something, you know, and do I need to discount the price? I think we are all in the process of trying to convince people of something where we should be.
That convincing is selling, but it's also developing that relationship and trust, too. And what happened?
Well, you know, I think everybody says this. It's when things go wrong, it's not so much what goes wrong, it's how you handle it that really makes the difference in terms of whether it's an individual transaction or whether it's something, you know, that threatens the survival of the company. Look at Volkswagen, I mean, which got caught, you know, cheating on the emissions. That's bad enough, but first of all, they messed up because their executives in Germany tried to claim it was just a few, quote, rogue engineers. We tracked that word rogue. It was reprinted thousands of times. You don't need to be a rocket scientist to know that was a stupid thing to say, and it wasn't true. And I always tell my clients, you always tell the truth because in a pinch you can remember it. Okay. And so Volkswagen has just got, I mean, what are we, a year and a half into that crisis now? And they're going to be a case study going forward. You got the original screw-up. What caused that? What kind of management failures were there? What kind of internal audit failures? Then you have the discovery, which is the short window. Okay, how did you screw that up? And then going forward, and to your comment a moment ago, Steve, they have a long road to go back building public confidence and trust.
And the opposite of that, as I think about it, must have been in the 80s, was a Tylenol scare. And the way they came back and turned that negative into a positive.
Johnson & Johnson, that's also become a very famous case study. Interestingly, the role of the CEO on that was determinative. And he's, as I won't mean, not that I was there, but as I studied that, he apparently said, you know, our consumers are at risk, and we're just going to do the thing that can protect it. It would be interesting to see if that could happen today. Because when things don't go well or aren't handled well, one of the things we always ask is, what's the role of the lawyers? And today the court of public opinion is really can be as important as the legal court itself. But so the Johnson & Johnson Tylenol thing, which I'm not sure is relevant today because we're in such a different world, but certainly one of the timeless lessons of leadership is do the right thing, explain why, and then deal with it. And they will stand as a shining example of that forever.
You mentioned earlier, and I want to come back to this, social media.
Let's talk
about that for
exploding.
A moment. And we've seen, as you made that gesture, we've seen social media change the communication landscape in the last few years. What role is social media going to have over the next few years?
Well, I think it's only going to grow. It's going to be confusing. It's going to have a lot of positive impacts. It's going to flatten or democratize communication. One of the examples that we're showing that we love, not a client, is Chick-fil-A, and they changed their barbecue sauce, and consumers hated it. And so Chick-fil-A bought back the old barbecue sauce, but they announced it by having their own staff sitting in their offices, there's other people in the background, and they're reading the text messages from their phone and then talking direct to camera. And of course, it's screamingly funny, as well as a big mea culpa, the barbecue sauce is back. That's almost free to get done. It requires that you move very quickly, and it requires that you talk to people along the channels that they're already accessing. My 25-year-old daughter, who is a math star and whiz, loves Snapchat. And it's one thing to say, honestly, how many pictures with pussycat ears do you really need of your friends? But she's a very important demographic, and if you want to communicate with her and you want to engage her, you're going to get good at Snapchat, no matter what you think of it.
And that's a part of now our communication. Instead of just newspaper, radio, TV, magazines, we now have social media, which is instant also.
Yeah, and the scary thing, I say this with great regret because I'm, when I ask my students at the Cox Business School at SMU here, what are you reading? And they're reading what I read in business school 35 years ago, Wall Street Journal, The Economist, Financial Times. Not one of them is reading it in hard copy. Only the instructor, only me. The rest of them are all reading. How can you read The Economist on your phone? I cannot understand that. But that's what they're doing. So nobody really reads anymore. And when you look at the patterns of even people who are reading things like that, they're not reading them the way I read them, where I thumb through, look at this article, read it back, maybe go back to the first part of it. They're reading the first paragraph, and, oh, this is interesting, hop to the next page. Oh, I think Steve would be, got to send in this article, send it to him. Hey, Steve, look at this, and look at this quote here. So there's interaction. Very different engagement patterns, and companies or any enterprise that doesn't understand that and utilize it is, I shouldn't say it's going to be toast, but it's going to be in trouble.
And they're learning to change that. You've also developed something called an influence model. How has that changed over the last 30 years?
Well, in some respects, it hasn't changed at all. The platforms, what you control, advertising, brochures, website, PowerPoint, branded clothing, that's still the formal network of communication. Media is still media, although, boy, is that network changing dramatically, and everybody with a cell phone's a reporter these days. And then what we call group or verbal communication, ranging from small groups down to person, which is increasingly video-enabled. And so you're talking to people one-on-one through some sort of device, not just a camera, but an iPhone or an iPad. So the basic concept that you have these various networks and you need them all and they need to be aligned is very much the rock of how we look at influence. But, of course, over time, that's updated. Under media, we've now got these virtual communities, which are fascinating to me. And sometimes they're organized, and sometimes they just spring up by neighborhoods. Social media, YouTube, Snapchat, Twitter, all those things, Instagram, can actually be classified under any one of the three major networks, depending on how the person that you're trying to influence looks at it. We see, alas, a lot of companies doing a lot on social media that's just garbage. And everybody looks at it and says, they're just gaming me. I mean, I really do not care about your new product that you're telling me about on Twitter. So you may be putting stuff out on social media, but the question is, you know, what's its impact? And sometimes it's fascinating. You cannot tell. I like to teach with case studies, and I'll give you an example of how this changes behavior or certainly changes thought process at a large hospital system that we deal with. And those, you know, they're always outsourcing things, insourcing things. One unit was getting outsourced, and an employee put on her Facebook page that she was being laid off from the hospital. That generated a call from the reporter in their headquarters city to the PR department, who of course had no idea what he was talking about. And they did the right thing. They said, we'll get somebody to talk to you in 30 minutes. He didn't wait. He posted on his blog, an unknown number of people are being laid off from name of hospital. Well, it went through the hospital, whoosh, like that, and the hospital lost people it wanted to keep. So you step back and you think, how do you prepare for that? We can teach anybody to put in place a system where you can get back to somebody in 30 minutes. But in that case, responding instantly is probably a standard we will never get to. And yet we need to think about it. We need to involve the legal department because they're going to have a say in this, HR. I mean, it's a really significant challenge today.
Apparently it is. Now, coming back to your business, and we mentioned this 30 years a few moments ago, this is your 30th anniversary. Now, did you pick the birth of Spaeth Communications because of your favorite president's birthday? Or was that just coincidence?
It was coincidence. I needed to contribute to our family's financial stability.
What advice do you have for leaders these days? Because that's what you do. You work with leaders in organizations to help them communicate more effectively with their consumers or clients. But what advice do you have for them going forward?
Well, I would have a number of pieces of advice, but the first and summary one is we use golden rule management. I was old enough when I started this that I'd worked for lots of different organizations. And in my 20s, I worked for a lot of different news organizations, most of which didn't last more than a year because every time a new news director would come in, well, things would happen. We try and treat people the way we would want to be treated. And that means in every aspect of respect, opportunity, kindness. So I, no matter how large the organization, I still think that's critically important. Once you move off that sort of broad philosophical, quasi-religious advice, you got to recognize today that things are very transparent. And if you're a leader, you got to walk the walk and talk the talk. You can't say we're a team; everybody else gets cutbacks or layoffs, and I'm giving myself, you know, a big bonus. People notice that very quickly. Word spreads both officially and unofficially. So I think the Army does a great job of this. You know, the good generals will tell you, if my guy's sleeping in the mud, I'm sleeping in the mud. So that's the second thing. And then the next thing is remember, both what you say and how you behave will be imitated. Our piece of this is to recognize that people pick up and repeat each other's words. And I think that's our special area of expertise in helping companies think through what's called messaging, but it's really just what you want people to hear and repeat. But we want it to be very intentional and not haphazard. So hopefully that's not too much advice for somebody to absorb and one that will make them a better leader.
Take some time to really study that. It could make them a better leader. But as I was thinking about that, not only are you in the communications business, but you're also in the change business. You're working with your clients to help them change perceptions of themselves and or their products. So is that what you look at when you're working with a new client and see what changes you'd like to see them develop?
In part, change management is a huge part of consulting today. And we've been privileged for 30 years. Arthur Anderson was our initial investor and client, and we attached ourselves to them. And the head of consulting in the 1990s for Anderson used to say that the first thing in change management is getting people to think that it's possible. And once they adopt the possibility of it, he would say the rest is all implementation. And people get used to doing things in a certain way, and so you can't come in and say, well, let's do it differently. They have to embrace what you're doing, and they have to make it their own. The head of manufacturing for Arthur Anderson in those days, great guy named Steve Horonic, used to say, we can go into any plant and I can tell you by that afternoon how we can save them money and improve efficiency. And 6 months later, it's all disappeared. If I can get them to invent it themselves, then it will stick and really create change. And I've taken all those lessons to heart and it tried to imply them in our small corner of the business.
In other words, from a CEO's point of view, is to get your people to make it their idea. So they own that idea.
Absolutely.
And they implement it. In looking at your office, looking at the walls of your office, you have a number of mementos from your years in Washington, D.C. So let me ask you about your mentors. Who are the people that you respected so much you wanted to glean as much as you could from them?
Boy, at this stage in my life, there are so many. Judge William Webster from the FBI would have to be at the top of the list. When I got to the FBI, I was the only non-lawyer on his executive staff. That was his third year at the FBI, and the special assistants all had liaison duties with the sexy departments, criminal, you know, foreign counterintelligence, the fun stuff. The only department that didn't have a liaison was fingerprints. Nobody wanted fingerprints. And they were just beginning a transition from 95 million paper files to this strange process called automation. So I got fingerprints. And I went to the director to say, since I don't know a lot about fingerprints or automation, you know, what's my job description? And he said, your job description is to make sure that I hear things that people think I don't want to hear or that they don't want me to hear. Within 24 hours, it was clear what that meant. And Webster was a great leader. I watched him in meetings that I couldn't talk about because they were talking about, but where he was a tremendous leader in terms of moving the FBI forward. Jim Miller, the director, the chairman of the Federal Trade Commission, you know, gave me all kinds of freedom. Of course, obviously President Reagan, but I reported to Jim Baker, the chief of staff, and the greatest chief of staff that the White House will ever have, who gave me the freedom to invent all these new things. Then so many people here, as we started our little business, really our first couple of years of clients, not just the Arthur Anderson folks, but countless numbers of names. And the way that they were mentors, Steve, is that they would come in and they'd say, here's our latest challenge, and we think you can help. And so they would give me opportunity. And that's such a precious commodity. One of the things I lecture to everybody is you can't expect equal outcomes, but you can commit yourself to providing opportunities for people. Every good thing that has happened to us, this is not an overstatement, every good thing that's happened to us has happened because somebody has done something nice for us, has recommended us without being asked. Okay. So I feel as if I have an enormous amount that I need to give back or pay forward.
And it's a lot to pay forward also. You said a lot. You have a lot to offer. If someone wanted to find out more about what you do in your company, where would they go?
I think the first place, the easiest place to go is our website, www.spathcom.com. We've got a blog. I write, I guess I shouldn't say prodigiously. I write a lot, and there are links to all the articles. We have, as you might imagine, as much video as we can stuff on that, because the future is video, 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 video. And I think you could wander around our site. And I hope you would enjoy yourself. You not only learn about us, but hopefully you would be entertained as well. Can I mention our monthly memo?
Absolutely.
Okay. Please do sign up for our monthly memo. It's called the Bimbo Memo, B-I-M-B-O. And it's blunders and bloopers, but it's actually a very serious teaching tool. And one of the things that we pay attention to, as I said, is we pick up and repeat each other's words, and negative words cause all kinds of problems. And the most common and the worst mistake is repeating and denying a negative. And it goes to this hearing process, which is so interesting. People tend to factor out the denial, so they hear the opposite of what you're trying to say. And we named the genre for the young woman who was caught with a very high profile, but unfortunately married man. And she held a press conference and announced, "I am not a bimbo." Of course, causing everyone to think that she was. And so every month we collect the three best bimbos. So it's real short, you know, easy to absorb at a glance, and a reminder that it's real important. And then for the truly addicted, you can click through to the full bimbo, which has my favorite category called Just the Wrong Thing to Say. And it has I collect examples of statistics. There's always a social media example or two in there, usually problematic. But the point of the little bimbo memo is, as far as we can tell, everybody who gets it reads it because it's funny. But it's also a real serious reminder that these tools can have a major impact.
Well, Mary, thank you very much for being a guest on Playmakers Talk Show. You definitely are a playmaker.
Well, it's been an honor and a privilege. Thank you so much.
Thank you also for listening and joining us. Join us again at PlaymakersTalkShow.com, where you can get all of our replays and past episodes. That's PlaymakersTalkShow.com, and we're going to be back with more Playmakers. See you then.
You've been listening to Playmakers Talk Show with Steve Klein. Join Steve again at PlaymakersTalkShow.com for more interviews with interesting and successful playmaking CEOs and executives.
Playmakers.